I don't like words that hide the truth. I don't like words that conceal reality. I don't like euphemisms or euphemistic language. And American English is loaded with euphemisms because Americans have a lot of trouble dealing with reality. Americans have trouble facing the truth. So they invent a kind of a soft language to protect themselves from it. And it gets worse with every generation. For some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat. Most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables, shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now, takes a little longer to say, doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time, and the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to eight syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. I'll bet you that. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is because we were using that soft language, that language that takes the life out of life. And it is a function of time. It does keep getting worse. I'll give you another example. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I wasn't notified of this. No one asked me if I agreed with it. It just happened. Toilet paper became bathroom tissue. Sneakers became running shoes. False teeth became dental appliances. Medicine became medication. Information became directory assistance. The dump became the landfill. Car crashes became automobile accidents. Partly cloudy became partly sunny. Motels became motor lodges. House trailers became mobile homes. Used cars became previously owned transportation. Room service became guest room dining, and constipation became occasional irregularity. When I was a little kid, if I got sick, they wanted me to go to the hospital and see the doctor. Now they want me to go to a health maintenance organization or a wellness center to consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And they're broke. They're broke. They don't have a negative cash flow position. They're fucking broke. Because a lot of them were fired. You know, fired. Management wanted to curtail redundancies in the human resources area. So many people are no longer viable members of the workforce. Smug, greedy, well-fed white people have invented a language to conceal their sins. It's as simple as that. The CIA doesn't kill anybody anymore. They neutralize people. Or they depopulate the area. The government doesn't lie, it engages in disinformation. The Pentagon actually measures nuclear radiation in something they call sunshine units. Israeli murderers are called commandos. Arab commandos are called terrorists. Contra killers are called freedom fighters. Well, if crime fighters fight crime and firefighters fight fire, what do freedom fighters fight? They never mention that part of it to us, do they? Never mention that part of it. And And some of this stuff is just silly. We all know that. Like on the airlines, they say they want a pre-board. Well, what the hell is pre-board? What does that mean? To get on before you get on? They say they're going to pre-board those passengers in need of special assistance. Cripples! Simple, honest, direct language. There's no shame attached to the word cripple that I can find in any dictionary. No shame attached to it. In fact, it's a word used in Bible translations. Jesus healed the cripples. Doesn't take seven words to describe that condition. But we don't have any cripples in this country anymore. We have the physically challenged. Is that a grotesque enough evasion for you? How about differently abled? I've heard them called that, differently abled. You can't even call these people handicapped anymore. They'll say, we're not handicapped, we're handicapable. These poor people have been bullshitted by the system into believing that if you change the name of the condition, somehow you'll change the condition. Well, hey, cousin, doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. We have no more deaf people in this country, hearing impaired. No one's blind anymore, partially sighted or visually impaired. We have no more stupid people. Everybody has a learning disorder. Or he's minimally exceptional. How would you like to be told that about your child? He's minimally exceptional. Oh, thank God for that. Psychologists actually have started calling ugly people those with severe appearance deficits. It's getting so bad that any day now I expect to hear a rape victim referred to as an unwilling sperm recipient. You know? And we have no more old people in this country. No more old people. We shipped them all away, and we brought in these senior citizens. Isn't that a typically American 20th century phrase? Bloodless, lifeless. No pulse in one of them. A senior citizen. But I've accepted that one. I've come to terms with it. I know it's here to stay. We'll never get rid of it. That's what they're going to be called, so I'll relax on that. But the one I do resist, the one I keep resisting, is when they look at an old guy and they'll say, look at him, Dan. He's 90 years young. Imagine the fear of aging that reveals. To not even be able to use the word old to describe someone, to have to use an antonym. And fear of aging is natural, it's universal, isn't it? We all have that. No one wants to get old, no one wants to die, but we do. So we bullshit ourselves. I started bullshitting myself when I got to my 40s. Soon as I was in my 40s, I'd look in the mirror and I'd say, well, I guess I'm getting older. Older sounds a little better than old, doesn't it? Sounds like it might even last a little longer. Bullshit, I'm getting old. And it's okay, because thanks to our fear of death in this country, I won't have to die. I'll pass away. Or I'll expire like a magazine subscription. If it happens in the hospital, they'll call it a terminal episode. The insurance company will refer to it as negative patient care outcome. And if it's the result of malpractice, they'll say it was a therapeutic misadventure. I'm telling you, some of this language makes me want to vomit. Well, maybe not vomit. Makes me want to engage in an involuntary personal protein spill.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to The Global War on Tribal Islam. Akbar Ahmed talks about his latest book, The Thistle and the Drone, and comments on the recent debate over the use of drones by the Obama administration.
But we are... Our footprint is going to be much smaller after 2014.
Well, that's again a choice we're making, and I'm not entirely happy. I would want a bigger footprint, but a different kind of footprint. I've mentioned this already, Peter. If you had colleges like the one I went to, which, by the way, is a university now, and they've opened up a women's wing, if you had 10 of these in Afghanistan, spread throughout the tribal areas, think of the impact there. Think of the future generation. In one stroke, you're changing the direction of a nation. If we value education, knowledge, the law, a compassionate civil society, we must understand, Peter, so do the Afghans, so do the Pakistanis. We must try to convey this to them, not the fact that we just turn up with soldiers and guns and missiles and drones, because that will immediately have local society resisting. So the paradigm has to be thought out, and that paradigm can only be thought out if the debate begins. So I'm hoping that we will act as a catalyst to this debate.
Professor Ahmed, how does the Sunni-Shiite issue that we've talked about for the last 10, 15 years play into this?
It does and it doesn't. It does in the sense that there is a large Shia minority in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. And they play a role. They play an important role in the army and in various institutions. It isn't out in the surface yet. It's still under the surface. But what the suicide bombers are doing and the Taliban are doing, because of their very extreme understanding of Sunni Islam, they're also targeting the Shia. For example, in Pakistan, in Quetta, where I was commissioner, they killed 100 Shia. Now, that's appalling. That's a complete breakdown of law and order. No government can allow that, and yet it happened. So that's something that's simmering. Iran is a very strong, aggressive Shia power, and it has interests in the region. So again, it plays its own great game. That balance has to be kept. So if you have an understanding in terms of the region, I think it can be contained, the Shia-Sunni tension.
The country of Mali is emerging as a battleground.
Yes, again, it's in the book. Read the book. It has exactly the same paradigm. You have the Tuareg. You've been hearing about the tribes. These Tuareg are tribesmen like the Wazir tribesmen and Masood in Waziristan. And they have been marginalized. Their lands have been robbed. Their mineral resources have been stolen. They have been really treated as third-rate citizens on their own traditional lands by their central governments. So there comes a point when they say, enough is enough, we are being killed and raped and tortured, we are going to react. And they react. Now, unfortunately, this is not a very civilized or a very educated part of the world. These are tribesmen. Most of them are illiterate. They only act according to their own tribal codes. And the primary code is the law of revenge. So they go out and they go berserk. They're chopping people's hands and killing people, etc. The central government then responds with force. Western powers get involved, and very quickly the cycle begins again. And again, we are not understanding the dynamic. The dynamic is the center and the periphery. If you can help resolve that, you've solved the problem. If you can't resolve that, hammering them and throwing bombs at them is not going to resolve it, because the central conflict will remain untouched.
In your book, you also talk about the Philippines. What is going on there?
Philippines, again, same situation, exactly the same. The Tausig, a Muslim minority group up in the fringes in certain parts of the Philippines. Now, they've been independent for centuries, and they're seeing the same process. The central government coming in very aggressively, taking their lands, converting their lands into by settlers from outside into lands which where suddenly they become a minority in their own lands. And in the Philippines, I found something interesting, Peter. The Philippines have taken an initiative to reach out to these tribal groups and bring them on board. And how did they do this? They simply negotiated. They said, okay, you want autonomy? You want to preserve your culture and your customs? Fine. As long as you're not rebelling against the state, we have no objection. And just that simple initiative, that simple human act, and a remarkable general who actually stood up, a general, think of it. I mean, think of an American general doing this in front of the Tausig population and actually apologized. He said, what we have done are atrocities, and I apologize. And people were crying, and the mayor of the Tausig mayor was in tears. And that just calmed things down immediately. Because again, he reached out to the human side of the enemy. Again, walking with the skin, under the skin of the other side. If you do that, things suddenly start changing. And I think, Peter, we have to start using other paradigms in order to impose some sort of stability and law and order in these rather turbulent regions of the world.
What about the use of drones in the Philippines?
They've been used. There's rumors, because remember, this whole drone program is covered with disinformation, obfuscation, vagueness, darkness, all kinds of clouds. Neither you nor I have any idea about this. So we do know that there have been reports, there have been write-ups that drones have been used there. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. And this is another tragedy, I think, of the present situation, that we can't say for certain. I asked for this study, I asked some very distinguished senior Americans. I said, who's behind the creation of these militant suicide bombers in the tribal areas of Pakistan? And without thinking, they said, Pakistanis. And I said, but why would they be wanting to blow up their own schools and buses? He said, no, because they've got some bigger game. I asked Pakistanis the same question. Without hesitation, Peter, they said, Americans. Now, if this is the situation on the ground, where you have allies who don't trust each other, where you have the local people like the Afghans have no idea why the Americans are there and what they're doing there, you need a clarity of vision. And that must come from Washington. Why? This is the superpower. This is the power that's driving the world, in a sense, and driving this war on terror. What is the long-term vision of the United States for these societies? What does it want to communicate to them? And how is it going to set about doing this? That clarity will help. And, you know, with light, darkness disappears. Right now, there's a lot of darkness around the drone program.
Professor Ahmed, where did the title, The Thistle and the Drone, come from?
Well, you know, Peter, I'm a professor on campus, and I love ideas. Leo Tolstoy, the great Russian novelist, wrote a novella called Haji Murad, in which the character is accompanying the Russian Imperial Army in the Caucasus Mountains. And they're fighting these Muslim tribes. And he goes for a walk and he finds a flower, he plucks the flower, and it's a thistle. A thistle, as you know, is a very prickly flower. And he says these tribes are just like the thistle. And remember that the thistle is the symbol of Scotland. And I know Scotland, I know the Scots, I have great respect and affection for them. The Scots are very much like the thistle. They pride themselves on their culture, their traditions. You can't walk over them. They gave a very tough resistance to the English over history. And Western commentators have very often compared Muslim tribesmen to Scotsmen. So very often Western writers, I've quoted dozens, who would compare the Pakhtun in Afghanistan and Pakistan, particularly in the tribal areas, to the Scots. They would say these are just like the Scots. They're like the thistle. They're prickly and they're hard and they're very fiercely independent. So I thought that the thistle represented one kind of society today in the 21st century, and the drone represents another kind of society. It is the ultimate killing machine of the age of globalization. It's sleek, you don't see it, you don't see when it's coming, who's behind it, why is it coming at all, is it coming at all, it's even being denied it ever came. Very much like Wall Street, if you remember all the senior executives, you had no idea what they were doing, how they were doing it, whether you could even hold them up for retribution or for the process of law, and they got away with it. So you have one kind of society in confrontation with another kind of society. And again, I believe that these issues have to be discussed in the context of the age of globalization. We are living as a global society. Anything we do here in the United States has an impact over there, and vice versa. And therefore, this title, in a sense, tries to integrate the two.
And we have been talking with American University Professor Akbar Ahmed about his most recent book, The Thistle and the Drone, How America's War on Terror Became a Global War on Tribal Islam. This is Book TV at American University.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
It's Living on Earth. I'm Steve Kerwood. They used to sing about foggy London town, but after World War II, the British capital was more famous for its swirling smog from coal-burning power plants, coal fires in the hearth, and diesel buses and trucks. The worst incident came in December 1952.
I don't think the blatant devil himself could have driven it away. It was that thick. On that night, it was vicious.
It was a warm fog. It was wrapped around you. It was all possessing.
It was smelly, it was dirty, it was black.
It had an acrid, acidy feel about it.
It seeped into the houses, and indoors everywhere's covered with a sort of grey film. It's quite uncanny.
As many as 12,000 deaths were blamed on that killer smog, and the British government was forced to act, passing the Clean Air Act in 1956. The United States, which had its own killer smog in Denora, Pennsylvania in 1948, passed its own Clean Air Act in 1963. And since then, health problems due to poor air quality have fallen dramatically in both countries. Without similar environmental protections, China is now facing a dirty air crisis, with toxic levels of air pollution throughout Beijing this past month. Jocelyn Ford is a journalist and a filmmaker based in Beijing, and she joins us via Skype. Welcome to Living on Earth.
Hello.
So what's it like there, or particularly, what's it like to take a breath there?
Well, on a bad air day, I actually try not to go outside because I don't want to be breathing in the equivalent of a pack of cigarettes a day. You know, you can feel it in your lungs, your throat gets all clogged. It's really not very pleasant. I've tried to avoid even going to yoga so I wouldn't have to breathe deeply.
So how far can you see from your apartment?
I usually see, I have a wonderful view. I'm on the 16th floor. I can see all sorts of skyscrapers, you know, miles away. But this past month, it's more or less looked like a Chinese ink painting with a little different shade of gray the further you go, and then it just becomes totally misty.
What are people saying in the press in particular about the air? Any criticism of the government?
This is the first time that Chinese state media has really been paying attention to the dangers of bad air. Back in 2008, when China started to clean up its air for the Olympics, the air would be bad and people say, oh, it's just fog, because the media never talked about the smog. But now people are aware that the air is bad. The Chinese government has started making public readings on just how bad the air is, and people are becoming much more concerned about their health and about their children's health. There's a lot of concern, for example, that kids shouldn't be outside playing in the playground when the air is really putrid. And the public is really up in arms about this. They want the government to do a lot better job. And there are a number of foreigners who are now thinking of, yeah, is it really worth staying in China with all of this?
And what's your answer? Are you coming home?
The days when the air is bad and the internet doesn't work, and I think, yeah, what am I doing here?
You know, we'd send you a bottle of oxygen, but probably the government wouldn't allow it.
Actually, they're already selling it here, so I'm afraid we can probably get it cheaper.
Jocelyn Ford, filmmaker and journalist, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, February 9th sees the start of the Year of the Snake, and the Chinese people love nothing more at New Year's than to let off fireworks, which could worsen their smog. Scientists know that air pollution causes multiple medical problems for the people who breathe it in. But now a team of researchers from around the world has demonstrated a connection between dirty air and low birth weight. Mothers exposed to high levels of particulates, the scientists found, are more likely to give birth to underweight children, putting them at risk of developmental delays and illness. One of the study's lead authors is Dr. Tracy Woodruff, the director of the Center for Reproductive Health and the Environment at the University of California at San Francisco. She says that the size of the study's sample shows that their conclusions should be taken seriously.
We had over 3 million births in our study, so this makes it a very large study. In fact, we think it's the largest study that's been done to date to look at this question about maternal exposure to air pollution and effects on birth weight.
Now, in which countries did you do your research?
We had participants in 14 centers from every continent except for Africa. We had several researchers in Europe, Brazil, Seoul, Korea, Australia, in Vancouver, Canada, then several locations in the United States, including California, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Massachusetts. A lot of people had been conducting studies in their individual countries looking at air pollution and adverse pregnancy outcomes, both low birth weight and preterm delivery. And they all were done a little differently. They all found slightly different results. So we gathered all the researchers together, and through our discussions, we realized if we worked together, we might have a stronger ability to look at this relationship between air pollution and pregnancy outcomes. We developed a protocol so that everyone would do the same method in each of their studies. They applied the same protocol, gathered the results, we aggregated them, and then that was the result of this study, is we could actually look across all the centers and pull all the information together to get a robust estimate about the relationship between maternal exposure to air pollution and low birth weight. What we found was that there's an increased risk of low birth weight with increasing levels of particulate matter air pollution.
What was the increased risk?
We saw an increased risk of 3% in low birth weight. It's not a very large increase for one person, but we're talking about millions of pregnant women around the world who are exposed to this. Because so many people are exposed, you can have many people who are affected across large populations.
Why does birth weight matter so much? Why is it such an important statistic?
Birth weight is a very important indicator of essentially fetal health, and doctors and public health practitioners are all concerned about the extent to which there's low birth weight in the population. Babies who are born too small can be at increased risk of chronic conditions either during infancy or in childhood, things like increased risk of infection. They might have developmental delays. And now we know that being born too small at birth can be an increased risk of adult disease. So things like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, what we call metabolic disorders. So really being born too small can kind of set you off on a less healthy path in life.
We're hearing a lot about air pollution in China right now. What would your study suggest might be going on in terms of the long-term effects of this rather poor air quality?
It reminds me of the very earlier air pollution episodes that actually led to the regulation of particulate matter air pollution, such as the London fog in the 1950s, which also had very high levels of air pollution. In terms of reproductive and developmental health concerns, the London fog episode, while they saw people actually dying and going to the emergency room into the hospital, they also saw an increase in infant mortality from that very high air pollution episode. And I would anticipate in China that that would be an issue for very young infants. And I would also anticipate that this would be affecting pregnant women and increasing their risk of potentially adverse pregnancy outcomes.
What do you hope comes out of this research?
Well, one of the reasons we were very interested in doing this research is to be able to provide people who are trying to make decisions a better estimate about the relationship between air pollution and pregnancy outcomes. Decision makers are looking to figure out, if I have to do a regulation on air pollution, what are the potential benefits from regulating air pollution? And when they look in the scientific literature, it's often difficult to understand the meaning of what the different studies say because it's not aggregated in a way that's useful for policymakers. So a second goal of the study was to essentially provide a better understanding about the relationship and an estimate that can be useful for people who are trying to make decisions about air pollution.
Tracy Woodruff is director of the Program of Reproductive Health and the Environment at the University of California at San Francisco. Thank you so much, Professor Woodruff.
Thank you.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.